For me, I knew I was gone because I always cry when people pray for me. Yes, I'm excited and a little bit nervous. Not gonna lie. So since Courtney already prayed, I won't pray again. Instead, we'll just start with the recap. So we are in chapters 6 and 7. But looking back to the very beginning, we are introduced to King Ahasuerus, lavishly displaying his wealth and his power in a feast. We see him humbled and angered when Vashti, his queen, doesn't obey him. After the king listens to unwise counsel a couple times, he, seeking his pleasure above all, selfishly seeks more virgins. We meet Hadassah, and soon she, a humble Jewish girl in exile, is elevated to queen, still Jewish and still in exile. The king is almost killed, the plot thwarted by Mordecai. Mordecai isn't honored, but Haman is. Man, it just keeps going. Mordecai didn't bow to Haman, and this angered Haman to the point that he wanted to kill all of the Jews. But he didn't want to wait to kill Mordecai. Haman wanted to kill Mordecai as soon as possible because he was an obstacle to the joy and honor that Haman thought he deserved. So last week, in the lesson that Sherry taught, we saw Haman humbled by leading Mordecai through town on a royal horse, in royal robes, with a royal crown, declaring that this was the man that the king delighted to honor. So all throughout this book so far, there's been an ebb and flow of tension, but an overall crescendo leading us to this passage of what in the world is going to happen. And so we broke this into three different sections. The first being Haman's rush to what Esther has prepared. The second, the king is prepared and determined to grant Esther's request. And the third, the king is prepared to harm Haman. Overall, we see the enemy of God's people continues to fall as God's people continue to receive favor and rise. Let's read. So chapter 6, verse 12. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning, and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he? Who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the queen and the king. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." And the king said, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Whew, a lot happens here. We're going to start back with verse 12. Here we see a contrast of character between Mordecai and Haman. Mordecai simply returns to his post at the king's gate after being honored throughout the city. This demonstrates humility. As Paul writes in Romans, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment. This is Mordecai. Haman, however, after being commanded to honor Mordecai, dejectedly hurries home with his head covered. In chapter 3, Haman had been honored above all people, save the king. And now in chapter 6, Mordecai is honored and Haman is not. As Sherry said last week, we're seeing a reversal of fortunes here. So the powerful is becoming humbled and the humbled are being exalted. Haman's wife and friends, after hearing of what has happened, read the writing on the wall. In chapter 5, when Haman talks with his wife and friends, there's no mention of wise men counseling Haman. In chapter 6, in verse 13, we see the addition of wise men. They no doubt knew of Israel's history and had heard of the Israelites' God. And God uses them to foreshadow the fall that is to come. During this conversation, the eunuchs arrive and quickly take Haman to the feast that Esther has prepared for Haman and the king. This language subtly reminds us that Haman is going to be a participant at the feast, but isn't in control. Esther is firmly in control of the goings-on. The language of hurried home and hurried to bring show how Haman's fall is accelerating. I picture Haman falling off a cliff, falling faster and faster by the second. Haman is rushed to what Esther has prepared. So what exactly has she prepared? We know she's prepared a feast. The king and Haman were invited to the initial feast in chapter 5, and while at that feast, invited to this feast, this second feast that they're at now. And unknowingly, Haman was invited to his demise. How did she prepare? During the mourning time after the edict was sent out, the Jews had a period of mourning. And we see that in chapter 4. And Esther asked all of the Jews in Susa to join her and her handmaidens, or her servants, in praying and fasting, asking God for wisdom and protection. She recognized her and her people's dependence on God in this dire situation. So through God's wisdom and guidance, Esther has crafted this situation to expose Haman's wickedness. So this takes us to our second point. The king is prepared and determined to grant Esther's request. So now they're at the feast, and on the second day, the king again asks what Queen Esther's wish and request are. She has crafted this feast and is waiting and has been waiting for just the right time to explain what's going on. From the king's language, we see his fondness for her and proof of her increased influence toward him, which is pretty cool. So in verse 2, he refers to her as Queen Esther. This gives her honor. And it shows us how God has been giving her favor. We see in chapter 2, the king loved her more than all the other women, and she won grace and favor. In chapter 5, when she went to request his presence at the first feast, she had to gain favor in his sight before being granted access into the court. And the narrator also refers to her as Queen Esther, once again reminding us that she has risen in favor and influence. She has risen from a Jewish concubine in exile to a Jewish queen still in exile, but in a position to be used by God to save his people. That's pretty exciting. The king is prepared to grant her request, and we see this in the strong statements that he makes, also in verse 2. It shall be granted you, it shall be fulfilled. So, for me, even though I see how the king is prepared and determined to grant his request, he's said it multiple times, I still have a question. Will he actually? Because we know the king and Haman have been drinking. From prior passages, we know that the king is easily swayed, and especially so after imbibing. We've seen him act rashly and in anger. So how will he respond to this shocking news that will soon be told to him? Haman wants to kill his Jewish wife. How will he respond to her request? who will he listen to? His queen or his trusted advisor? So Esther responds to his questions, what is your wish, what is your request, cunningly. And she does this in a few ways. One, she recognizes his desire for power and pleasure, as well as his authority. She uses words such as, if I have found favor, O king, if it please the king. So she's recognizing that he is in authority over her. Two, she uses the same language as the edict, which announced the future destruction of all Jews. So in chapter 3, we see the language of the edict when Mordecai gives it to her, specifically to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Verse 4, for we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. 3, she doesn't blame the king, but rather paints him as a fellow victim in this situation. And she does this in a few ways. One, also in verse 4, she refers to the loss of the king. Their suffering isn't to be compared to the loss of the king if they had been merely sold as slaves. This is loss of revenue, loss of workforce, loss of people in his kingdom to boast about. The fewer people in his kingdom, the less boasting ability he has. Secondly, she uses passive voice when explaining. If we had been, I would have, so that she can avoid naming the king as the one who has carried this edict out. She names Haman as the almost perpetrator of this genocide without mentioning the king's role of giving him the signet ring, giving him the money to carry it out, and giving Haman the ability to do as he pleased. 4, she waits until the king is anxious to know who is working against him to reveal Haman's treachery. So she didn't just come out and say, hey, Haman's working against you. I'm going to die. She explained and kind of got him worked up. She demonstrates humility, recognizes his power, and asks for her life. She asks for the ability to keep living, to not be killed. She asks for her people to not be killed. This is courage. So courageous right here. And sacrificial love. The king could have banished or killed her right then. He had gotten rid of his favorite wife before, so why wouldn't he do it again? She's going against Haman, his most trusted advisor. So once again, who will the king believe? She's asking the king to go against his royal edict. Remember the one that his signet ring put out to kill all the Jews? She's asking him to go against that. She's putting herself on the line, sacrificing her safety, putting her head on the potential chopping block for her people, for God's people. So how will the king respond? Will he still be determined to grant her wish? As you know, the king responds in fury toward Haman, and Haman responds in terror. We see Haman fall further from honor here. He went proudly to the feast expecting honor, but instead he was outed as a traitor. We see that in verse 6. He recognizes that the king and queen are united against him and that his influence over the king is no longer existing. This is a massive reversal of fortunes. Humble Hadassah transformed into powerful, influential Queen Esther. High and mighty Haman has been humbled and his wicked intentions, the genocide of the Jews, revealed. With this, the king is prepared to harm Haman. In his wrath, the king went into the garden. Maybe he had to think about what he was going to do to Haman. Maybe he had to think about how to extract himself from his part in sending out the edict. Haman may have written it and sent it out, but the king okayed it and gave his signet ring to seal it. Or maybe he was going to cool down. We don't know. And we don't know exactly how long he was in the garden, but we do know that Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, and that the narrator wants us to feel the quickness of the situation. The king left and came back. So as the king returned, he came upon Haman falling on Esther. So before, this part has always confused me, because I knew that they lounged when they were eating, and so in my head, I'm literally picturing Esther lounging, and then Haman falling on her, and I'm like, how does that work? It really confused me. So if you had that same mental image, it isn't that. He was falling at her feet, reaching toward her in desperation, begging for mercy. That makes a lot more sense. Just side note, teacher training is great for clearing up confusions and misunderstandings. So seeing Haman assault his wife sealed the deal for the king. If there had been any doubt about whether or not to punish Haman, there wasn't now. The king ordered him to be executed. In teacher training, Pastor Jeff taught us that the Hebrew phrase used for the word in verse 8, the king gave the word, refers to a judicial sentence being pronounced. Earlier in 6:12, Haman covered his face in shame. And now his face is being covered because he will be executed. It is immediately covered once the king pronounces judgment. The ground is quickly coming up to meet him. Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, gives counsel to the king by offering further information on Haman's plan, as well as offering a way to kill him. Harbona made sure to mention Mordecai by name and that he saved the king. The king, as we have seen him do before, accepts the recommendations of others and does as Harbona suggests in how to kill Haman. Haman is falling below yet another person. In a great twist of irony, Haman is impaled on the gallows he had built to kill Mordecai. He fell before Mordecai, the representative of the Jews, the people he wanted to annihilate. His death hints at the more significant death later on. So ladies, this chapter is pivotal in the book of Esther and in the Bible. Without the king listening to Queen Esther and responding in this fashion, the Jewish people would be destroyed. All of the Jews in the Persian Empire, which included Israel, would have been killed. Jesus would not have been born, and man, us, we would still be forever dead in our sin. God's promises to Abraham in Genesis 12 and 13 would be shown false. If Mordecai had been killed, his name wouldn't have been great. He would have been dishonored, and that would have been quite the poor representation of the Jewish people. But rather, God fulfilled that promise and cursed Haman to death. Abraham's lineage can continue and become as numerous as the dust of the earth. Throughout this morning, we've mentioned reversal of fortunes multiple times, and I hope that you've thought of the great reversal of fortune that we have in Christ. Christ was humbled to the point of rejection, humiliated, killed, and then resurrected and honored to rescue his people. He is worthy of all honor. In Revelation 5, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fall down before the Lamb, singing, "Worthy are you to take the scroll." Oh, no. "Then I looked, and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing.' Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, 'To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever.' And the four living creatures said, 'Amen,' and the elders fell down and worshipped." I love these verses. They convict me every time I read them to direct my heart and my eyes to Christ. I'm convicted every time to give him the power, all the power, wealth, wisdom, might, honor, glory, and blessing, because I want them for myself. and I don't deserve them. Only he does. I deserve death. All of it, all of that praise belongs to him, not to me and not to you. He made purification for my sins. I didn't and I can't. He upholds the universe with his power, not me. Hebrews 1 speaks to this. Another way we see Christ in this passage is through contrast. Haman got a little bit too big for his britches, and we're all that same way. Haman sought justice by wanting to kill Mordecai. The king sought justice by banishing Vashti and killing Haman. Yet their justice is imperfect. God's justice is perfect. Romans 3:23 through 26. Verse 26, it was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of one who has faith in Jesus. God's justice is perfect because he is righteous. He is glorious in his righteousness. God didn't spare his son, his holy, righteous son. Jesus was treated as an enemy of God so that we, his true enemies, could be reconciled to him. Jesus was rejected by his father so that we who rejected him could be forgiven. In Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. And if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain on the all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. We all have committed a crime punishable by death. Sin. We are born sinners, doomed to the curse of death. And Jesus took that curse upon himself. The holy, righteous Son of God took our curse. God justifies those whom he calls, and he protects his people. So ladies, if you are still under the curse of death, if you find yourself sitting here realizing that you are still God's enemy, we need to talk. Haman was the enemy of the Jews, and God killed him to protect his people. He killed him for his glory. God killed Haman for his glory. We are God's enemies, destined to death, eternal separation from God. But he has provided a way to life through Christ. Amen.